Explosive new allegations about why Tucker Carlson and Fox News really parted. We have right here today on the show the author of the brand new book called Tucker. You can pre-order it now, and he has a very interesting theory about all of this. We're going to dig in and try and figure out just exactly what went down. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the program. I am Trish Regan. So good to have you here. A reminder that portions of the show are brought to you by Legacy Precious Metals. If you're interested in investing in gold, go check them out at legacypminvestments.com today or call them at 1-866-589-0560. All right, so the Tucker thing, it's been a big deal. Everybody's wondering, how could this have happened? I mean, wow. I mean, they've made some changes there, and apparently more are coming. There has been the revelation by Drudge Report that they're doing a big shakeup. I guess they have to because the ratings are just tanking. They're in prime time. Tucker Carlson, meanwhile, says he's going over to Twitter. Well, what's really happening and why did all this happen to begin with? I'm thrilled to welcome to the program the author of the brand new book, Tucker, aptly named, Chadwick Moore. Hey, Chadwick, good to see you.
Hey, Trish, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So everybody's talking about this. I mean, the incoming has been massive. In fact, we'll start getting, because some of the viewers may want to weigh in. They may have their own theories or questions. But let's start with sort of the basics. You wrote this book. It's available for pre-order now. It's called Tucker. And they can get it at Barnes & Noble. But I guess my question to you is, how much access, I believe you had a lot, did you have to him? And how much of this book was written after this whole ordeal?
Right. So, yeah, we started working on this a year ago, and Tucker, I'm an independent biographer, so it's not an authorized biography. Tucker's not seen a word of the book, nor has he asked to. Mm-hmm. And he's been totally open over the last year. He's given me, you know, unprecedented access. Anytime I wanted to ring him up or wanted to come and hang out with him or trail him, he was totally available and open. The book was basically done by March of this year, and we are always planned to launch this month. And then, of course, the news happened. In fact, the week his show was taken off the air, I had a phone call scheduled with him, just had like five housekeeping questions. You know, did I get this right? Can you explain this more? And this happened. So I interviewed him two other times since this news. I updated the book and added some more chapters about the aftermath and what happened and what my sources have told me happened. And other than that, you know, I just had to kind of go through and change the tense from present to past whenever we talked about his Fox show.
Wow. I mean, it's wow. I mean, it's kind of an author's dream and an author's nightmare, right? Because suddenly now you're writing about the most talked about guy in America while simultaneously having to scramble to kind of get the rest of the story. And I know you've been doing that. And I know you've been sort of pounding the pavement and ever the reporter trying to figure out just exactly what went down. I got to tell you, like, I worked there. Management was not bright because for some reason they decided to put me on opposite Tucker Carlson at 8 p.m. Not a place I even wanted to be, but I remember thinking at the time, like, why? Like, you know, you got this great star over here. And it did seem to me that no matter what, they wanted to protect him. That was important to them, obviously, right? Like, he was a cash cow. He made them a ton of money. And regardless of, you know, advertiser snafus here and there, the reality is people watched Fox News because of Tucker Carlson at 8 p.m. And for them to lose him, I was stunned. Was he stunned himself?
Oh, yeah, he was. So he told me that Monday morning, April 24th, I happened to be on his last show, April 21st, Friday, which none of us knew was going to be the last show. And that Monday, he already wrote his monologue for that evening show, sent it to his producers, and got a phone call around 11 a.m. from Fox News President Suzanne Scott. And she just said, "We're taking your show off the air. Thank you very much. Goodbye." And at the same time, two other executives called his producer, Justin Wells, and told him the same thing. It was sort of a coordinated job. And they still have not given him an official explanation. Fox News has not officially told him why. He's been left to speculate ever since. So the first time I spoke to him, yeah.
I know the feeling.
Exactly.
No, yeah. He didn't deserve this. I would just, nor did I, nor did anybody that sort of unceremoniously just, you know, got the rug pulled out from under them. And no sort of explanation as to why. It's interesting. And so you've been kind of digging around, trying to figure it out. What are your sources saying?
Yeah, and well, and firstly, you're right that he was appointment television. People scheduled their lives around that, you know, their days around his show, and it's becoming very clear that he propped up the entire primetime lineup. And everything I keep hearing from my sources is what you just said about management not being very bright, because that explains a lot of what is confusing a lot of people right now. I've been hearing that over and over again. So what my sources had told me, so news had already been out there that this was a condition of the settlement with Dominion. Dominion has, of course, denied this. Fox
Whoa.
has denied this.
Wait. What do you mean news had been out there that was like
Well,
being circulated among?
people were already circulating this, but I had heard this before I was reading these reports. Now, all I can say is that my sources, who I have no reason to believe are lying to me, this is what they told me. I don't know if it's true or not, but this is what they told me, and it was already out there in the news anyway. So, you know, we sort of came forward and said this. We put a video on Twitter saying that this is what I had heard. And of course, Dominion says it's not true. Fox says it's not true. Tucker retweeted the video, and Tucker didn't know that that's what we were going to say. So, you know, that was sort of interesting. You can make of that what you will. But you know, it happened 6 days after the settlement that his show was taken off the air, and that it seems clear that it was somehow tied to this case, and whether it was a condition with Dominion, again, they've denied it, or maybe it was Fox just saying we're going to put the foot down and, you know, scare everyone a bit to stay in line and get rid of our biggest host.
Wow. Well, you know, I look back over my time there, and you mentioned management. I mean, I wonder if, you know, people wouldn't have been this far out on the ledge, right? If it had been managed. And by the way, actually, Tucker was not going after Dominion that hard. Like, I
Oh,
mean,
no.
I think there were plenty of other examples where they, in fact, some of the reporters did actually pursue that storyline, but he wasn't one of them. And I would just say that, you know, in terms of management, that's where you would expect management to come in and say, you know what? By the way, this is why I don't love networks, right? It was the freedom to just do whatever I want and not have to answer to somebody above. But typically, and I've worked at different networks, and I'm sure Tucker would tell you this too, in a well-managed shop, there's kind of an editorial guideline, right? Or guidance. And there are people that fall in line. And if you don't fall in line, you're probably not going to have a long career, maybe at that network. Again, I don't love networks because I don't want to necessarily have to do what somebody else wants me to do all the time or follow a particular editorial line. But in the case of this, it almost seems like you had people doing all kinds of extreme stories. And in some cases, they may have genuinely believed them and were pursuing them for those reasons. In other cases, maybe not. I don't know. But where was management? Like, why wasn't anybody? I mean, how did it wind up that they were getting sued for $1.6 billion, Chadwick?
Yeah. And you're completely right that Tucker really did not push this theory about the voting machines being rigged. And in fact, when Sidney Powell came on his show, he really took her to task and kind of humiliated her. And he demanded, "Where's your evidence? Where's your evidence? Where's your evidence?" And it was clear that he kind of thought she was a nut. So he didn't push this. While other people on Fox who did more strongly push this theory that not many people think is true, they still have jobs and they're still on the air at Fox. So it's really interesting, and it's such a bombshell and so confusing on so many levels.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if, you know, this was a condition, you know, was Suzanne saying, I can't operate this way. You know, if he's working against me, this is Suzanne Scott, the CEO of the company. Typically, you would also see in a normal sort of news environment, it's usually management that goes first because you build your stars up, right, for a reason, and they make you money. And he certainly made them plenty of money and was a talent. And so you do what you can to protect that star, and you know, whether you like it or not, sometimes management is the one that is the first to go. And this was a very different situation. So perplexing. I mean, the Dominion theory is interesting. Let me ask you about this, because my whole background, of course, is as a business and economic journalist. So I'm always intrigued by what's going on behind the scenes in terms of who has ownership, for example, in the stock. And, you know, Fox is traded under both an A and B class shares. The A class is the voting stock. B is the more public one. But anyway, there's a company that you probably know, certainly Tucker knows, called BlackRock, and it's sort of the, well, king of ESG. Larry Fink, nice guy. I've interviewed him many, many times over the years. He is the force behind this. And this ESG stuff means that all the companies that they invest in at BlackRock, and they control a lot of the investment community because they have some, you know, $14 trillion under asset management, they're controlling where your pension money is getting put. So they can buy shares of Fox, they can buy shares of whatever they want. In fact, they've got a pretty good chunk of almost every major company. But I was looking at it, they've got like 5% of Fox A, 5% or so of Fox B. Do you think, I'm just throwing this out there, I mean, Tucker was really aggressive on the ESG stuff, really aggressive. And I think he was full on right, because I don't think it's a good thing for our economy. I look at it kind of a Ponzi scheme in the stock market. I don't like any of it. But he was touching a nerve that, you know, was the a nerve that might have had a lot of say, shall we say, right? With it could pick up the phone and say, hey, Rupert, what is your guy doing? Could that have related to anything?
I mean, this is what a lot of people theorize, is that, you know, he obviously touched a nerve on a lot of issues, ESG being one of them. And he took a counter narrative in mainstream media and on cable news, especially against, you know, both the establishment left and the establishment right. I mean, there were so many issues, whether it was the ESG thing, whether it was Big Pharma, whether it was the war in Ukraine, that he was singular in and very bold in his professing what he felt about them. And that upset a lot of people. So if there are powerful business interests that wanted him off the air, and especially ahead of the next presidential election, you know, he's still an employee of Fox News. He's being paid to not have a program as we speak. His contract
again,
runs out.
Again, know the
after,
feeling.
Yeah, his contract runs out after the next presidential election. Yeah. So, you know, these are all things that people should rightly speculate about, and also is unprecedented in our media landscape if, you know, maybe some private equity firms can control what kind of news programming people can listen to. This stuff is I talked to media lawyers who believe that something like this is what happened. And they said that they had never heard of anything like that before either. But it was certainly a chilling effect on the First Amendment and in news programming in this country, if it's true.
You know, for sure. I mean, but look, stranger things have happened. The New York Post got its Twitter account shut down because, I mean, who's to say? And I think this is why the public and so many viewers here, and I'm going to get to some of their questions and comments in a second, but so many viewers here are like, wait, you know what? I want to be able to trust my source. I want to trust the individual. And I want to make sure that I can sort of seek out all the people that I want to hear from. And I think that's a big change, by the way, Chadwick, that's going on in media in general, right? The content is what matters. It's not necessarily the distribution mechanism. Yes, 8 o'clock at Fox News was a great place to be, but you have to have the talent to be able to deliver. And if you put, and we've seen it, right? You put all these other people in, and if they don't have the je ne sais quoi, or the intellect even to be able to carry that spot, then it's not going to work. And your ratings are going to be cut in half, as we have seen. But simultaneously, if he goes over to, say, Twitter or YouTube or anywhere, I think, again, people are responding to the content itself. And it's kind of like, what's the expression? You know, cream always rises to the top. He's going to be fine. He's going to do great. What's going on with the Twitter show?
Yeah, well, even with that, so what people have also told me, and back to this conversation about management, which you know much better than I do, is they said, you know, they still sort of think that they're the Fox News of 20 years ago and that it's the brand that matters and that these faces are interchangeable. But they didn't realize that Tucker's brand was as strong, if not stronger, than their own, which maybe they are starting to see now. What I understand with the Twitter show is that Twitter's rebranding everything under X. So it's now owned by X Corp. There's obviously SpaceX. And they're launching a new video platform called X Video, which sounds a little dirty, but it's meant to be a competitor to YouTube, apparently. And so this is different than the Twitter Spaces that Ron DeSantis announced on, that there was a bunch of bugs and kind of a terrible rollout. This is supposed to be a YouTube competitor. And the reason why this is so attractive and why they're heading there first, what I'm told, I've not seen Tucker's contract, but I was told that Fox News failed to include Twitter in their non-compete. So he's actually able to go to Twitter and not... And also Twitter's more attractive because Elon now takes it over. However, there's this new president of Twitter who's kind of like a World Economic Forum lady, and people are a little suspicious of her. But I'm told by Tucker's producers, that the ones who left the show to follow him where he's going, and left Fox News, that they don't feel, you know, committed to stay to Twitter. They're going to test out the product. If they like it, they'll stay, or they might go somewhere else. There's also talks of launching their own media empire, basically.
Why not? Right? I mean, look, I think that that's, again, with content being what is so critical here, you look at examples like Daily Wire, right? Where they're putting out a ton of content, a ton of very interesting, great, funny, diverse content, and people are finding it. And so that company has, last I checked, I mean, don't misquote me, but a pretty large valuation. And I think that there's a tremendous opportunity there, and he just has to figure out what he wants to do. Tell me about the non-compete, because I've been through that too, and it's not a lot of fun. They give you a good kick in the pants on the way out the door, but the way these deals work is there's a clause in there called pay or play, and they have sort of the option to take you off the air and keep you off the air and kind of keep you from doing anything. And if you go do anything else, they say, oh, well, you know, we can use that income against what you would otherwise have. But they're even more tricky than that. And I don't know how Tucker's works, but sometimes you don't even have the option, right? Even if you said, okay, well, I don't want your money. Like, forget about it, guys, we're done. I don't need the rest of the contract. In some cases, you still are vulnerable because of these non-competes, which, by the way, need to get thrown out the window. Thank you very much. I mean, they're very antiquated, but nonetheless, it exists. And I guess he has to work within the bounds of that.
Well, it's a form of indentured servitude. I mean, some of them are really nasty. And I believe there's a Supreme Court case coming up, actually, that deals exactly with this, with these non-competes, because as you said, they can be really destructive. And so I haven't seen Tucker's contract. I don't know. That's just what I've heard. But I do know his contract, just, you know, watching him, was a lot more loose than a lot of people on Fox, because a lot of people on Fox, you cannot have your voice or your image anywhere but a News Corp property. I couldn't even get Fox hosts to give a plug for my previous book because I could only give plugs for News Corp books. And even though I was regulars on their show and all this other, you know, just one little line. So, but Tucker was always on podcasts. He was always out giving speeches. The fact that he was participating in this book with me would probably not be allowed for most Fox personalities. They sort of told the executives, hey, we want to work with Chabot on this book, and the executives were supportive of it, I was told. But he had a much looser contract than a lot of people I'm aware of. But again, I haven't seen it, but I was told that somehow Twitter was left out of it.
I wonder too. Good. I wonder if this is also becoming sort of a new wrinkle, because they're like, wait a second, no, you can't go anywhere else digitally. And, you know, so if he's smart, and I know he is, he's actually extremely smart. And I did not agree with everything Tucker did on the air, you know, full disclosure. And I was in the unfortunate position of being, you know, within the same house opposite him, which, again, I just never thought was a bright move. I begged them not to do that. And somehow wound up still nonetheless at 8 p.m. Anyway, I just think that he's intellectually there and present in ways that you don't often get in television. And it's why he kind of had a unique spin. And, you know, again, I didn't agree with everything, but I always thought, wait a second, this is a guy who makes you stop and think. The first time I ever met him, actually, I was filling in for Megyn Kelly on some, you know, holiday weekend in July that nobody wanted to work on a Friday night. And there was Tucker, and he was in studio. And I so appreciated, somehow we were talking about the economy or something on the air. And it was very rare that I would ever hear sort of a take on interest rates in the Fed. And I remember him just diving into this. And I'm like, yeah, because, you know, I love talking about that stuff, but it's not for everyone. And it's very rare that people would have the kind of versatility, right, to be able to go there and have a meaningful discussion on something that was really more of a, you know, sort of a heady economic topic. But he could do that. I mean, he had that versatility, and he could go in a lot of directions, which is, again, why, you know, he's going to be fine. I don't know about Fox. By the way, like, Fox is getting kind of touchy, I hear. They're not welcoming you onto their programs anymore, Chadwick?
I was supposed to be on Greg Gutfeld's show tonight, actually. And the day I announced my book, I got an email about an hour afterwards with some hilarious and lame excuse about how, like, oh, we're overbooked. I mean, I've been a regular on Gutfeld since the show launched 2 years ago. And, you know, that's never happened. And if they do have a problem, they say, can we get you on tomorrow or next week? And I was also a regular on some other shows, not heard from any of them.
So they just went stone cold quiet, like no explanation or anything.
Yeah, you know, like this is lame, and I don't need to be on television, but you know, people ought to know that this is how they act. I know that that Tucker's name is forbidden from being mentioned on air, and Greg Duckwell did it once, and he's never done it again. So it's like Voldemort, the name that shall not be mentioned or whatever, which is so, like so lame, you know, and I don't know. But I'm not really upset about it because I miss the people there. And I'm sure you probably do because there's some really wonderful, wonderful people who work there.
A lot of them are over at Newsmax, interestingly. I feel like half my team's over at Newsmax.
Yeah,
you know? And by the way, Newsmax is doing great. Like, look at what Eric Bolling is doing. It's incredible, right? So they've seen a lot of tune in. But there's still a chunk of the audience that's gone, like just gone. And I'm like, okay, so where did they go? I feel like people have been finding me like out of the blue. We've had the channel for a little while and all of a sudden they're coming and finding me. I think that all sort of hosts on these different platforms are now seeing this amazing response from viewers who are saying, wait a second, I'm not going to be dictated to by this big company that, you know, has a giant ESG shareholder in it.
Yeah. And it's just amazing. They don't see that. I mean, not only the shifting political paradigm, which I think is why Tucker connected so well with his audiences. And you mentioned earlier how he could talk about things that might seem boring, but be completely engaged. And his talent was that he wouldn't talk about something unless he genuinely cared about it. And you can't get away on television with doing that unless you do care about it. He would talk about things like architecture that no other cable news host could get away with. And it was engaging television because he really believed in what he was saying and he was excited about the topic.
So any thoughts on Hannity?
That is a rare talent.
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, but you compare and contrast, and nothing against Hannity. He's a very nice man. A very nice man. But it's a different take on things, right? I think Tucker really did a great job on the cultural stuff. You know, I've always tried to have my lane in economic stuff. Hannity is very political. And so in that sense, it becomes, dare I say, somewhat predictable, right? What does the RNC think? Okay, let's be spoon-fed it over here. And I think what was cool about what Tucker did was that it wasn't always in line with what status quo thought or what the RNC thought. And he'd come at things with a very different edge. And that's what made it watchable, exciting, and different. Do they have anyone there now that can do that?
Yeah, and you think about some of his segments, it would go from being really hard-hitting to being fun and tabloidy. And he had regular animal segments on his show because he's a huge animal lover, as I learned and saw firsthand. You know, he'd have people with like emotional support alligators, and he'd have the chicken lady on. And that was so unexpected and fun and made the show so rich that not many people could get away with that.
Yeah. You know, I'm just looking at some of the comments from everybody. They're really into this, you know, Vanguard and BlackRock, very concerned about those particular companies. There's been some chatter out there, and I just want to clarify it because I see some of the viewers talking about this, about their investment in Dominion. I don't actually believe that's the case. Dominion was a private company, as I understand it, and I think was owned by a private equity firm primarily, but not BlackRock. But I do think that, look, we're living in a time, and you know this, you see this throughout all of the things that are happening right now, whether it be Bud Light, and the effort to kind of just remake society in some way, shape, or form. I mean, the Harvard girl, right? It's apparently like they're not teaching marketing 101 at Harvard these days because she kind of made the most obvious faux pas and alienated her audience. It's become a many, many, many billion-dollar mistake, and people aren't sure if Bud Light as a brand is going to continue to exist, Chadwick, at this point. And then you think about Target and the challenges that they've been having. Their stock's been sinking. Last I checked, they were down about $10 billion in market cap. And then I look over at Fox. I think investors are relieved that this whole Dominion thing is out of the way, but we saw the stock really get hit the day the Tucker news came out. And now investors are saying, well, can management take this company forward? Just like you have over at Anheuser-Busch, people are like, I don't know if the CEO is capable of finding his way out of a paper bag right now because, look, it was like mistake after mistake after mistake after mistake. And so the challenge for Suzanne Scott And for Lachlan Murdoch right now is, can they see this through to the other side? And they better have a pretty winning product, because I don't know, I think viewers feel burned. And when they're burned, like you see at Anheuser-Busch, it's not good.
And conservatives especially are like the most brand loyal people on the planet. And but as soon as you turn on them, they're never coming back. You see that with Anheuser-Busch, and maybe you're seeing that with Fox as well. You have these like waves in recent years of Fox doing things that really upset some core viewers. Calling Arizona early was one, Tucker being another major one. But those people don't come back. And it's certainly a hard lesson to be learned. Anheuser-Busch, all they had to do was fire one person and issue an apology, and they would have been fine. And why couldn't they even do that is beyond anyone. And wow, I was at a Kroger the other day, and they didn't even have Anheuser-Busch. They'd have no Bud Light for sale at all right before Memorial Day weekend. They just pulled it off the shelf. And that was pretty amazing.
Amazing. I know. It's incredible. And really kind of, I think, a big wake-up call. And I think Fox ought to be looking at this, you know, heart and soul here, saying, okay, what do we do? Because this is not a good omen. And there are other places to go, other places that they can go. Before all this happened, I mean, what was the book really about? Was it just about sort of his childhood, his rise to fame?
Yeah, that's still mainly what the book is. It's a biography of him. You know, this stuff is just now looking at this, now that he's going to be totally unbounded after he's done with Fox, this is kind of really the origin story, and where he goes next is what he becomes next. But I want to know who he is, what inspires him, what's his life like, what kind of a guy is he? And, you know, I was spent time with his father, his wife, his friends, his family, just to be like, what's his world like? Where did he come from? And that's what we did here. You know, this latest news.
What was it like? Didn't he have like an heiress mom? And
so, you know, a lot of people think he came from this super privileged family, but his mother, his biological mother, yes, was California royalty. Her name was Lisa Lombardi, but his dad was an orphan. His dad was a scrappy journalist. He was not from privilege by any means. He married, Lisa Lombardi, his mom,
and married
she
well.
Left. Yeah, well, she left the kids when left the family when Tucker was 6 years old, and he never saw her again for the rest of his life.
Oh my gosh.
She wanted to be like a free-spirited bohemian girl, and she did that. And then Tucker's father remarried to another big California name, Patricia Swanson, who is a Swanson Foods heiress. But she was sort of cut out of the family. You know, they didn't really have – they were fine growing up, but they weren't – you know, they didn't live this extremely privileged life. They ate at McDonald's and Denny's, and, you know, he went to boarding school, which a lot of people can't afford, but it wasn't the best boarding school. And so a lot of people think he came from really like – he was like a Vanderbilt, but it's a little more complicated than that.
Interesting. And, you know, does that grounding and maybe some of those experiences, does that help inform some of the content that he delivers? Let me ask you this. How much does he – believe all that he's saying, like really, you know, in his heart, there's conviction about what he's talking about in terms of the values he presents on the air.
He's a natural debater, and he loves debate, and he also loves riling people up. And he's been in, you know, debate since he was in high school. You know, his high school friends are saying that as soon as he joined the debate team, it became a spectator sport, and he would debate staff, and people would show up and want to see that. And I believe everything. I think he doesn't say something unless he believes it. You know, there's a tendency to think, especially the left will assault conservatives and say they're just doing that for attention. They're grifters. I don't really believe that. It's sort of a knee-jerk reaction to anyone who's effective and threatening to them. You know, I believe that he believes everything he says on air. And I think that when he realizes he's wrong, he will try to make up for that or apologize for it, which he's done on air many times. You know, I think his upbringing had more to do. His father is very similar to him. His father, you know, really hated hypocrisy. They both have a strong disdain for the nanny state. And it's really funny to talk to his dad about how much he hates the nanny state. And Tucker has that as well. That's when he gets the most fired up, is when they want to ban gas stoves or menthol cigarettes. And so that's also entertaining to participate in. So his upbringing itself, I think, had the greatest impact on really who he is as a man and who he is as a father and as a husband. He came from a family of dysfunction and abandonment on both his father's side and mother's side. And I think that really shaped the kind of man that he wants to become. He's not someone who politics controls his life. You know, that's his job. And he has a very rich personal life and a rich spiritual life, which I really enjoyed getting to know and writing about.
Hey, and look, that's all that matters really at the end, because, you know, I appreciated the photos of him off to dinner in the golf cart in Florida after everything had just gone down. And, you know, when you can wave at the camera and smile because, you know what, you got other stuff in your life. There's more important stuff than Fox News. That's where you need to be. I mean, it's a very important thing to remember. We are talking, everyone, with Chadwick Moore. Chadwick is out with a brand new book. You can pre-order it, called Tucker, a bio he had been working on long before all the news came about, and one that he had to go back and make some changes to and amendments to and add some context to in light of Tucker Carlson and Fox News parting ways. How tricky is it for Tucker right now? Again, like, I just think about myself, and I guess we were amicable enough. I mean, under the circumstances, I just think that, he probably got caught very off guard, as did I. And there's very little that you can sort of say in that interim as you're trying to unwind everything. Right. I mean, he can't like disclose to the world exactly how he feels or exactly what happened. Is that problematic from him from a legal standpoint?
Well, he was very generous about Fox and the Murdochs when I spoke to him after the show was put off the air. He had nothing bad to say. In fact, I asked him about the sort of things that we were just talking about. You know, did it have to do with, I think specifically I said, your stance on the war in Ukraine. And he told me flat out, February 2022, Lachlan Murdoch came over and had dinner, and I was coming under a lot of heat for my stance on Ukraine. And Lachlan straight up said, you know, we disagree. The Murdochs are big Zelensky supporters. Tucker is not, obviously. And he said that Lachlan said, we disagree, but you can say what you want on your show. We're free to disagree. And Tucker said he was very grateful for that. He thought he was very blessed to have a boss that would let him disagree so publicly. So he only
but
had
he
really
didn't
nice
really.
Things to say.
I mean, I think that was a misconception, right? It was like, go for it. I mean, I think back to even my time there. It's like, go for it. And yet, like, you know, apparently you can't really, you have to be cautious about what you say. January 6th was a big issue. You know, he came out with his stuff for Fox Nation. Again, I think a lot of people, they made a lot of money off of him. They signed up for Fox Nation because they wanted to see this documentary series. And he released some of it on the air, and there was the promise that there was going to be more. And then it got pulled. A lot of people questioned that. Around a similar time or months later, you had Chuck Schumer on the floor of the Senate saying, We need to get this under control. You know, what Fox News and Tucker Carlson did was absolutely terrible. I'm paraphrasing, but I wondered if the Murdochs were at all worried of regulation. I mean, think about this, Chadwick. They lost that whole deal overseas, right? They wanted to become the biggest broadcaster overseas, but they lost out on that deal because Ofcom, which is the, you know, British entity that looked at them, just really didn't feel like the Fox brand was appropriate there overseas. Do you think that they were worried that we could go back to the sort of pre-Reagan days of having more regulated news in light of what Chuck Schumer was saying, in light of what AOC was saying? Literally, like, hours before this news came down on Tucker, she was out there on MSNBC on Sunday saying, we need to regulate Fox News and Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, and I saw his monologue that he planned to read on air on April 24th, the day his show was pulled, and he was talking directly about January 6th and Ray Epps. Ray Epps, the night before, had gone on CBS's 60 Minutes to attack Tucker's show, and he was given the star treatment by CBS. And then also, as you mentioned, AOC that weekend said we need to pull Fox off the air and kind of suggested he should, like, arrest people like Tucker Carlson. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly, he was going to talk about that on air the day that his show was pulled off the air. You know, I think certainly all that's possible. I've been hearing, you would know more than me, but I've been hearing rumors forever that News Corp wants to dump Fox because it's diminishing returns cable news model. And of course, you can't sell a property like Fox News if you have a firebrand like Tucker Carlson on there. So maybe all of this comes into play. I mean, there's so much going on. Everyone sort of believed that everyone knew that his show would eventually get taken off the air. I think everyone just thought it would be content related. And not specifically content related. He slipped up and said this on the air, and not the way it did happen, which is still mysterious to so many people.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair point. I thought at the time, especially with some of the press that had come out around the time of the Dominion case, especially with some of the things that even Rupert Murdoch said, it sounded like they were going after Suzanne Scott, Maria Bartiromo, who, by the way, I love. I've known her since my CNBC days. Jeanine Pirro, it sounded like that was the direction. I believe that Rupert might have even knocked Hannity in some of the depositions. So I was certainly surprised when it was not those people that one would have thought, because, and who knows, maybe things were being planted in the press and there was actually a whole other backstory going on. Very, very interesting. I wonder who does know, like who actually knows? Is it Suzanne and Lachlan and Rupert and that's it?
And well, apparently members of the board, there's, you know, mm-hmm. I think Tucker was somewhere saying that he had heard from them the reason why. So there's certainly a small number of people who do know it, probably the Murdochs and a couple board members. I don't even know if Suzanne knows, who knows what they told her. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there's so many things swirling around this that,
yes,
as I said, I don't think anyone's surprised that his show got taken off the air, would have eventually, but not in this manner. I mean, it was just so bizarre, but it seems clearly linked to the situation with Dominion. Whether or not that was a condition of the Dominion lawsuit, it doesn't matter, but clearly it was something to do with that whole situation, whether it was an opportunity to just lay down the law at News Corp and make everyone, you know, get into line and show a little strength.
Yeah, but they've done that before.
Showing who's his boss. Yeah.
Right. I mean, well, trying to think like, look, that, I mean, Lou Dobbs was out, myself.
Right.
I'm just trying to, you know, there's certainly been a lot.
Kelly.
Yeah. O'Reilly. Although, you know, O'Reilly yep. was some special, yep. you know, issues surrounding that.
Right.
But here's the thing again. And I just say this, like, I'm not a television producer per se, and I'm not running a network. And by the way, like, I feel for Suzanne. Like, I can't even imagine that, because trying to corral all those personalities, good luck. I mean, everybody's got a gigantic ego, gigantic personality. They all think they know better. To be able to manage a place like that, that takes some serious people skills, like really serious. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. So yes, she had a hard job. But what was just strange is that it got so out of line that they're now finding like, okay, we're going to cut that one off and that one off and that one off. Look, talent's hard to find. Again, if I were building a network today, I got to go out and find talent. And not everybody can sit here and just, you know, talk live on a camera for, you know, and entertain people and come up with new ideas and be pleasant to watch, et cetera. I mean, it actually is kind of a unique thing, and you can kind of, I spot it. Like, I think a lot of talent can spot it. They know when someone's good. And yet for whatever reason, you know, instead of managing him along the way and others, perhaps, it comes to where it just like blows up. Viewers are writing in, by the way, they like you a lot. Everybody's saying how smart you are. But anyway, in the live conversation, you know, they're saying, so what is this? Go for it, you know, so we can then fire you. Somebody, Annie is asking, is that sort of like they were tempting him with, here, you know, do this, do this, do this. And then finally, like, too much after Lachlan was like, yeah, that's fine. And then suddenly it's not fine. I mean, you ought to know, I think, and this was, I think in some ways, my frustration was you want to know that someone's got your back, that you are not out there totally alone. But if you are out there totally alone, they kind of need to make that clear too. And so, you know, in Tucker's case, if it was in fact his view on things like January 6th or Ukraine or whatever, and they're telling him, you know, go for it, while simultaneously, you know, writing up the pink slip, then that's not a great place to be.
No, it's not. And you know, maybe it's just a matter of if enough people call for you to get taken off the air and you don't have someone big and powerful as your back, then it's going to eventually happen. I mean, the Pentagon celebrated his show being taken off the air. There are all these Pentagon employees talking to the Washington Post, anonymously, of course, saying good riddance. I mean, what world did we live in? And of course, Republican senators and congressmen who would not give their name to the Washington Post were also celebrating this. So maybe it's just a fact that if there's enough people who call for it, it's going to eventually happen. Now, to Fox's credit, one thing in what you're saying about wrangling all those personalities is, you know, one thing that has made Fox superior in cable news is if you compare it to CNN. CNN has their meeting every morning with whoever the president happens to be at that time. These are the top stories. These are our take on it. And then you watch CNN all day long, and it's the same stories, and all the personalities have the same angle on that story, which yep. is, you know, awful and totalitarian and boring as all yep. hell. So Fox, from what I understand, doesn't have that. It's, and which is why you had so much more diversity of opinion on Fox mm-hmm. and why Fox would be. But I think a lot of people, a lot of conservatives, a lot of civil libertarians, I would kind of put myself in the civil libertarian mm-hmm. camp, they would tolerate Fox because they allowed Tucker. So all of these things that Fox did that they didn't like, and all these opinions and personalities, they would say, well, they still have Tucker on, so they can't be that bad. And now that he's not on, well, you know, goodbye Fox is what so many people are saying.
Wow. Now, what do you think really happens? I mean, Drudge came out with 8 p.m. Hannity. I think they had 9 p.m. Jesse Waters, and then 10 p.m. would be Greg Gutfeld. And then everybody's like, well, wait a second, where's Laura? And I'm like, oh, Laura did a lot on ESG too. She did. Yeah. I mean, she went after that, rightly so. I mean, I think it's actually going to be a big issue for our time. But I'm not sure where she lines up in all this. Any sense from your sources about when they're going to roll out the new lineup and whether, in fact, it's going to look as Drudge has reported?
I honestly have not heard. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I think moving Greg up to 10 is smart because it was always too late for me to watch it, but I don't watch Fox anymore, so I don't know.
And I
enjoyed being on there.
I don't,
do any of us really care?
No, you know what's crazy? Like, I get more news on YouTube, I feel like. And it's like way more fun and way more entertaining. And by the way, it's like part of Google search, right? So when you're looking something up, something from YouTube will come up. I get a lot of news from podcasts. I have to do my due diligence every day, right? So I go hit all the usual suspects. But then I actually don't enjoy watching television news. And maybe it's just because it's like I know how the sausage is made. I'm sitting there looking at their lower third, which by the way, I don't even have on. I just have to remind everybody, Chadwick Moore. He is the author of Tucker, brand new book. You can pre-order it at Barnes and Noble. But like all that jazz, and I was talking when I started this with guys like Dave Rubin, who've been so successful, and they're like, you know, it's so noisy, it's so busy, and really, it's a different medium over here. Like cable's so noisy and so busy, and they've got all the tickers and the this, the that, and the other, and you don't need it because it's actually the quality of the conversation and the content itself and the information that people are most interested in, and they're also willing to put up with a few less bells and whistles because of the authenticity of what is being delivered, Chadwick. So with that in mind, going with your theory that maybe Fox is not forever going to be this company that it is and owned by the Murdochs, maybe they spin it out. I mean, they got to be looking at their business and saying, yeah, you know, this thing prints money and it could probably print money for the foreseeable future, but we've got to rethink how we do this. We've got to rein in expenses. We can't have high cost talent because we can't broadcast this stuff live everywhere else. We have arrangements with cable companies.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, most people get their news from podcasts like yours or from Twitter. They're not watching cable. Tucker brought in a whole new audience that traditionally shouldn't belong on cable and kind of, I think, artificially extended the life of cable, really, you know, and especially young men and young people. And he had the highest rated show of young Democrats, 18 to 45 year old Democrats in all of cable, which is interesting. But I think what's so upsetting to a lot of people about his show being taken off the air, because as you had said, and as all of your listeners know, he will be fine. He will go on. He will be out there. But what I think is so upsetting is that our leaders don't care what's happening on Twitter. They care what's happening on cable news. Twitter is for the plebs. You know, podcasts are for us little people. They worry about what the prestige networks are saying, like cable news and the New York Times. So at least when he was there, he had their ear. And I think the reason why his show being put off the air feels like a death for a lot of people is not only there's a big hole in their evenings, but because they know that our leaders are going to care a lot less of what he was saying and be less afraid of him. And that goes to Republican leadership, who I think was the most afraid of Tucker Carlson.
But couldn't he have just as big, if not bigger, a following on Twitter? I mean, I think about some of the work that I did there. And look, Fox News was the big kahuna, right? We were like the redheaded stepchild over there. It was like, why do you exist? But we were there over at Fox Business, and you know, we weren't getting the numbers that Fox News obviously got. So, you know, maybe, you know, a good night, you might pick up a couple hundred thousand there. And then on the West Coast, repeat another couple hundred thousand. And that was a successful evening on Fox Business. It would have been a super successful day, too. I mean, when I started, they were getting nothing. Like, they were like down around 15, 20,000. So I'm like, wow, if I can increase you 10 times, which I did, like that's a win. But in light of just sort of those poor numbers, what I found was we would take clips, which by the way, we're going to do with this, Chadwick, full disclosure, full warning, we're going to take clips of what you say and put it out there. And we'd take those clips and they would go so far. So they would just get retweeted and retweeted, and then they would become news. so whatever was happening on the show, like, great, whoopee, wonderful to have the tune in, but it's whatever the ripple effect was after. And so that always struck me as interesting. And it was a different phenomenon, right? Because, you know, I didn't have the 3 million people that were tuning in every night at 8 o'clock. I had a few hundred thousand, but I was able to get the same kind of effect by actually putting this stuff out on social media. So I'm hopeful. I say this because, you know, I'm ever the optimist. I'm hopeful that he's going to continue to have a voice, that we all have a voice, just in a new, different way.
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see how he changes now that he's no longer under the constraints of Fox. And he obviously had tons of freedom at Fox. No one was looking over his shoulder.
He did. It drove me crazy. I was like, so how does Tucker get to do that? Why does Tucker get to do that? Wait a second. You know, like he definitely, I was like, I need his agent to negotiate my next contract.
Right. Totally. You know,
anyway, he definitely had a lot of freedom, but now he's going to have even more.
I used to leave his show and be like, I cannot believe they just let me say that on air and they're going to have me back.
You've been pretty, what would you say that were some of your most sort of viral or outrageous moments? I told you before we came on live, I have a lot of friends that watched you on Tucker's show and they absolutely love you. So they're all running out to buy your book. You know, you have a lot of fans here as I'm reading some of the comments, but what would you say was sort of like your signature?
Oh, I guess what are my glory moments? Well, during Pride Month, drinking and eating Chick-fil-A on air on a show because the gays were coming after Chick-fil-A. That was really fun. I did a lot of food segments. I ate French fries on his show once because Bill de Blasio did this press conference where he was eating French fries during COVID. So I wanted to mock him. But we had a lot of fun just, you know, having a laugh because it was one place you really wanted that. And it was, his show could be really, what I felt was his show, you know, there'd be obviously a lot of serious things and dark things happening in the world. And I always kind of felt like they would think, we need a little lighthearted moment. So maybe they would bring me on and Tucker and I could cut up, which was, you know, always great. I'm really going to miss that. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, as you know, like Fox people, especially Tucker's people, never like told you what to say or anything like that. Yeah. They just would, here's the topic, come on and just, you know, let it rip.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a lot of fun. I'm going to miss that. We used to laugh a lot on this show.
Speaking of Pride Month, we're going into it, you know, and we've been seeing a whole lot of, I mean, have you seen the Raptor commercial? I mean, I think it's actually pretty great.
Oh,
for
yeah.
The Ford Raptor. I mean, this kind of looks like an awesome, really cool truck, but I don't know if they're going to alienate their audience. It hasn't quite caught on in the same way that some of the other stuff has, but do you think these companies are going too far?
I think anecdotally speaking, because I spend a lot of time in the South, that truck is the choice for gay men, especially gay conservatives. So maybe they just know what their audience is. But it's like stylistically done. It's a really beautiful commercial. But I'm just so like everyone else, just so sick of the rainbow. Like, give it a break. And it goes back to this whole idea of like these corporations that are like, well, if we just virtue signal to the right things and we can do anything we want, nobody's going to look at like any horrible business practice we have or whatever. It's like, you know, it's like this thing that started with the Clintons where they made it okay for liberals to worship money. I think this is all like an extent of that. And it's just like, as long as you just virtue signal to the right people or the right causes or, you know, talk about trans lives, then you can just do anything you want as these corporations.
Yeah, it's so maybe, gross. I don't know. I mean, until it goes too far, by the way, for those who haven't seen it, I'm just going to. It's pretty great. This is the commercial. So overall, you know, they can check out the book. I encourage them to do that. I think it's probably a pretty interesting read. And I think you were able to get background that most people just, you know, haven't explored with him. And it's obviously a very timely moment there with Fox News. And by the way, and I say this, you know, look, I had a wonderful however many years there, and there's a lot of wonderful people there. I really have only good things to say about. I just look at it and I feel a little bit sad for what it could be, what it should be, and really, Chadwick, what it was, right? I mean, that's perhaps one of the saddest parts. And I don't know what its future really is going to be, but it is kind of a lesson in the importance of having strong leadership and the importance of good management and the importance of, you know, really, you know, having some direction while simultaneously allowing people space to breathe, to have their own views, and not be CNN.
Right, exactly. Yeah, not the lockstep apparatchiks of CNN, exactly.
Yes, for sure. Hey, listen, I so appreciate you coming on the show today, and I hope you come back. When is the book due out?
It's due out July 18th. You can go to tuckerthebook.com if you want more information, or you can pre-order Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. So yeah, July 18th, but pre-orders are open now. And thank you also so much for having me on. It was great chatting with you. I'd love to.
Yes, very good stuff. And please give my best to Tucker.
I will, for sure.
Thank you. Chadwick Moore. Good to see him. So yeah, very interesting conversation. I am here with you. Wow. Really live today, right? What is it? Wow. We've been live for 50 minutes. Think about that. I'm going to have to cut some of this down for the podcast, I think. If you have not subscribed to the podcast, do me that favor on Apple, iTunes. I'd love to have you there. Subscribe to, or follow it. I think that you don't even have to listen. You can come watch it over here. Just follow it. It helps the algorithm. Algorithms. Look at what I'm learning in this new environment in which we live. I want to get out to some of your questions here. Yeah, you get some. There's some Raptor fans out there. See, I knew it. Fox Light Bud News. That's actually pretty funny from John Smith. He writes in Fox Light Bud News. That's pretty good. I mean, you wonder there. We've got another guest coming on momentarily, Greg Jarrett, who actually is from Fox. I hope he doesn't get in trouble coming on the show. After, you know, we just interviewed the guy who wrote the book on Tucker, Chadwick Moore. But he's going to be coming on momentarily. He's out with a brand new book called The Trial of the Century, and it's about a case that took place years and years and years ago down in Tennessee, where a teacher, a high school teacher, decided to teach evolution in the classroom and wound up losing his job, and it became a huge case. And Greg is a lawyer by background, and I'll be careful and sensitive not to ask him too much about Tucker, considering that you don't exactly want to bite the hand that feeds you, right? So Greg Jarrett is going to be joining us momentarily with that, but I want to go back to some of your questions. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate your compliments. Eric writing that I'm one of the few good ones out there and that he loves the show. I so appreciate hearing that. I really do. I mean, And oh my goodness, and Daryl McMillan writing that he has been a fan ever since some of those documentaries they did at CNBC, Marijuana USA included, years ago. Those were documentaries they did on this underground business, which I predicted, rightly so, would become a very above ground business, or sort of above ground business. So they were like the highest rated things, no pun intended, that CNBC had ever seen, and still to this day has ever seen in terms of original programming. We wondered if like the people just would like keep watching it over and over again, like forget that they watched it. Anyway, John Palmer, thank you. Thank you for your compliment there, saying that he relies on me and not others. I will tell you, I'm pretty upfront. I'm pretty straightforward about everything. And I know we don't always agree, and we shouldn't always agree. I think that part of our job is to disagree with each other. And that's part of what makes all of this really interesting. And so I always tell you exactly what I'm thinking. And, you know, whether you like it or not, we got the market down today, S&P 500 trading down almost 1%, NASDAQ down lower as well. You see, everybody, is concerned about these debt levels. They're concerned about just exactly where the U.S. markets and the economy are really heading, because, well, the fundamentals aren't looking so hot, right? The fundamentals aren't looking so hot because you see, we're in a situation where we are spending too much money. I'm still for getting a deal done. Now, you may not agree with me on that, but I'm like, okay, we are like in the line of fire, and we don't want to waste time, you know, fighting and bickering and grandstanding and seeing all the brinksmanship that you know that they do have, right, in Washington, D.C. right now. So they're going to continue to wrangle this one right up to the last minute. And I don't appreciate it. I think I would hope they would get it done. You don't want to go down in history, Joe Biden, as like the president who really blew it. I mean, we know you're blowing it on a whole lot of other stuff, but like, you default on debt, it's game over, buddy. I have spent my early part of my career, I spent trading sovereign debt, so effectively the treasuries, right, of countries that did default on debt, like Argentina multiple times, Venezuela, Brazil, Mexico. This was my first job, and so I was immersed in sort of the study of the politics and the economics in these places to see whether or not they're going to pay their bills on time, because that affects where the debt trades. It was kind of a Wild West environment there in emerging markets at Goldman Sachs. But anyway, that was sort of my introduction to it. And, you know, I studied a lot of history, especially early colonial history. I mean, look, this is what we were. The reason we are successful in America is because we're like the country that actually pays its bills. And so even though we keep running up this debt, which we can't afford, I mean, the debt to GDP ratio is getting insane. It's going to be more insane in the future. We still pay the bills. And if that changes, then your credit, I mean, think about it, like if you were a family, right? And you just didn't pay your credit card bills. Well, next time you go and try and borrow, it's going to cost you a fortune. So we don't have the flexibility to just say, well, we're not going to do this. In the meantime, you've got everybody saying, what's going to happen with the Federal Reserve? I think the Federal Reserve is going to have no choice. It's going to have to. Mark my words, it's going to have to at least keep rates where they are, maybe actually send them lower because, oh, we're going into an election year, 2024. And the Fed definitely doesn't want to have the stink around it of being the one that sent the economy into a recession right during an election, right? Then Joe Biden is never going to forgive them. Then they're really and truly in trouble. Again, looking back at your comments there, everybody wanting to make sure that there's as much news as you can get as we go into this election cycle, with one writing that Tucker needs to hurry up and get out of those contract negotiations so that we have another voice out there. Annie, I'm glad you found the show too. Annie writing in that she's glad that she found this. It's not easy. I will tell you, I've learned a lot about computers because you have to actually like understand like SEO. SEO is actually really important. So like we're learning as we go, and I've brought in some very helpful people so that those algorithms are helping to find us. So we're all doing our part, but definitely when you can spread the word and you can share this content and you can subscribe to the channel, and all of that matters. All of it really and truly matters. So I appreciate all your hard work on that end, guys. Target, I want to take a look at shares of Target again, because this is just unbelievable to me. I mean, and it actually is encouraging in that I do think everyday Americans really do have a voice, and it shows you the power of our voice, because when we don't like something, we vote with our dollars, we vote with our feet. And again, as I look at shares of Target, traded under ticker symbol TGT, they are down more than 1% again today at $132.29 a share. And to keep that in perspective, they were up around $160 before this whole thing with you know who, this person, Eric Carnell, who, let me show you, let me see if I have some video here that I can show you of Eric. Yeah, well, that's not actually Eric. That's one of Eric's designs. Eric is designing clothing according to his brand, which I don't believe this is online anymore, Obpralin, and it really kind of worships Satan here, talking about how, you know, Satan loves you, et cetera, et cetera. And this is kind of, you know, a slap in the face to moms that shop at Target, right? Like, they weren't selling that stuff at Target, but they were selling stuff by him, like some rainbow shirts and that kind of thing. And people figured out, oh, this guy has this other line. And that other line is, well, just a tad offensive, shall we say. So they didn't appreciate that. And consequently, they are not shopping there anymore. Myself included. Not that I shop that much at Target, to be honest, to be fair. But, you know, if I were going to shop at Target, like the three times a year I shop at Target, that's not happening anymore. And I think moms in general are like, yeah, you know, I don't think so, because this guy's too much. But what makes it worse is that Eric Carnell is saying this is effectively misinformation, that he's not a Satan worshiper. I'm sorry, am I misreading this, guys? Can we go and take a look at his Satan loves you and respects who you are. You're important and valuable in this world, and you deserve to be treated with respect. I've been thinking a lot about the Satanic temple, blah, 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 blah. I'm sorry. Like, I'm kind of taking him at his word. Was this just all a shtick? Because, you know, he was trying to get a new audience for his clothing. He's saying that, you know, people are, the religious right is making more out of this than it is. I think that it's not even the religious right. I think it's like everyone. Everyone that hears this story is like, wait, what? You know, you can only push us so far as Americans. At some point, something's got to give. And right now we're kind of reaching that point. This is what I would call a tipping point in America. And that's what you're seeing in schools with parents saying, oh, I don't know about this. Wait, what are you putting on display in the library? And you know me, I'm a big believer in everybody being able to read whatever they want to read. But these are kids. Okay, like you got to draw the line somewhere, people. And you're confusing them. And it's one thing to teach compassion. By the way, they can do that at church, but apparently liberals don't like church anymore. You know, compassion is a big part of who we are and forever need to be. But there's no compassion from the other side right now. Somehow they get to point the finger and say, oh, if you don't accept this biologically born man swimming against biologically born females, then you're transphobic and you're the bad person. Well, what if you're the swimmer that loses out to some biologically born man who recently decided he's now transitioning to be female and then she wins? That's not fair. Like, how does that help women? I mean, I say this as a woman and as someone who, by the way, has always considered herself a feminist in the true sense of the word. Like, I fully believe in the equality of men and women. And I don't like how feminists are always trying to, like, basically put feminine, traditionally feminine qualities down. The only one that actually gets to be full on, totally uber feminine is the biological man now masquerading as a woman. Like, that's okay.
Impressive carrying skills, right? I got some Bud Lights for us. So I kept hearing about this thing called March Madness, and I thought we were all just having a hectic month, but it turns out it has something to do with sports.
And okay, you got it right. So like somehow it's totally cool for the transgender or transitioning male to be super feminine, to the Kate Spade commercials and really, really work it. But it's not okay for naturally born women to celebrate their femininity. Like, I don't know what kind of mixed up planet we're living in, but I actually think it's problematic for our future as a nation. And I think if you look back in society, historically, there have been moments in time where this has happened before. And we just ought to be cautious and we ought to be thoughtful and we ought to think about, you know, where we're heading. I'm going to play some sound for you of Camille Paglia, feminist author and scholar who is so far left. She's probably right at this point. I think she is. I think actually the left is really getting annoyed with her. But, you know, she said some things and it's not appreciated by some that hear her saying them, but she's a realist and she's saying this. Actually, I'm going to play some sound from a lecture she was giving like back in 2015. And she was saying like, this is kind of a slippery slope and it's happened before in history. Listen to this and let's talk about it on the other side.
Proof of that. But now I began all of my studies, my book Sexual Persona began as a dissertation at Yale graduate school on androgyny. I've always been fascinated, attracted, you know, to the subject of androgyny, and that's what sexual persona is. I explored it in history. But the more I explored it, I realized that that historically the movement toward androgyny occurs in late phases of culture. Okay, as a civilization is starting to unravel, okay, and that you can find it again and again and again through history in the Greek art, okay, you can see it happening. All of a sudden, okay, there's a kind of the sculptures of handsome nude young men athletes that used to be very robust, okay, in the archaic period suddenly begin to seem like wet noodles, okay, toward the end, okay, and that the people who live in such periods, a late phase of culture, whether it's the Hellenistic era, whether it's the Roman Empire, whether it's the Mauve decade of Oscar Wilde in the 1890s, whether it's Weimar Germany, people who live in such times, okay, feel that they're very sophisticated, they're very cosmopolitan, okay? Homosexuality, heterosexuality, so what? Anything goes, and so on. All right, and so, but we, from the perspective of historical distance, okay, you can see that it's a culture that no longer believes in itself, okay? And then what you invariably get are people who are convinced of the power of heroic masculinity, okay? On the edges, whether they're the Vandals and the Huns, okay, or whether they're the barbarians of ISIS, okay? You see them, you know.
Okay, so that's actually pretty interesting what she's saying, that when a society starts to lose faith in itself because it doesn't understand like basics of, you know, what's male and female, you actually can wind up with a violent counter to that. And that is actually my big concern. And she walks you through those different times in history, including the Weimar Republic, including the, you know, the Oscar Wilde years. All of this actually is stuff that I wish these politicians, specifically those on the left that keep pushing this insanity. And I don't even understand why, because selfishly, like, it's not even good for them. I think Hillary Clinton admitted that, and she was attacked. She was like, yeah, this isn't going to play. Like, politically, it's not a good issue, because even liberals that you talk to at some point, like, they're like, wait, I can't have a role in my child's health beyond the age of 12 because there's an executive order from the president that says, you know, the state and the school and the hospital and everybody else can like team up, and I don't get a role in this. That doesn't make any sense. Like, really doesn't make any sense. Like, no matter how left you are, like, we are all human beings, and parental responsibility is a big deal that most of us take pretty darn seriously. So when you start trying to shut out the ability for people to have a voice in their own children's lives, well, you lose them. You just lose them. The danger would be, as Camille Paglia suggests, that you wind up going down a very treacherous path, because as the left tries to cling to some of this nonsense and the right is like, yeah, no, not having it, what does that set you up for? That would be pretty, you know, concerning. Anyway, again, just wanted to welcome everybody. Good to see Willie and Cordes back. He's such a supporter of independent journalism. Thank you, Willie. I appreciate that. Craig, you know, talking up to Trump a little bit, you know, we've got a big election happening. Big, big, big one happening. And the verdict's out. We'll see. I mean, the big question is Don versus Ron. Who is going to be the Republican nominee? Let me see if I can type that in for you guys as a poll. Dare I do? Do you want to answer that? Who would be the Republican nominee? I'm not going to actually try it because I'm not that skilled at typing and talking at the same time. But if anybody has a thought on that, I mean, all of the current polls, and let me see if I can find the newest ones for you. The polls have suggested, of course, that it would be Donald Trump. And I think it's pretty hard to come out of nowhere, so to speak, and beat him. Now, Ron DeSantis is seeing his name recognition go up considerably. He certainly, I will give him credit for doing a terrific job in Florida. I mean, one of the biggest mistakes that we made was shutting down our economy in 2020, as we did in March 2020. And you think back to what Florida did. I was down there recently, and I loved hearing this story. I was at a hotel, and the guy who was sort of running the restaurant there was walking me through what happened in those dark days of March 2020. He said, you know, we were only shut down for 2 weeks. 2 weeks. And then we were back up and running. And there were people that like just came from the New York area and just lived at the hotel because they just loved it, because you had a chance at having a normal life there in Florida, and everything was outside, of course. So they had that going for them. But Ron DeSantis certainly gets high marks for his response to all that happened, and being able to keep his economy open during that time was fantastic, and such a direct contrast to all those other states that did exactly the opposite. But can he actually win this thing? I don't think he's got the support thus far to be able to pull that off. I think that he runs the risk of effectively becoming a sacrificial lamb, if you would. And what I mean by that is Ron DeSantis is out there in part because there's a lot of money that would like to see him be the Republican nominee and feel that he's the best shot against Joe Biden. And so everybody's pushing him, right? Okay, Ron, like you can do it. And sometimes this is what politicians lack. You need to have tremendous self-awareness. And if he wants to have a long political career, I mean, if I were one of his family members, you know, I'd say selfishly, you know, let's hang on. Let's wait until 28. We don't have to be in a rush to do anything right now, because it could be, you know, going the other way. Anyway, we'll talk some more about Ron DeSantis versus Donald Trump in just a minute. We'll see if Greg Jarrett has any thoughts on it. But Greg Jarrett joining us, popping on the show right now to give us his take on his brand new book. It literally just came out, and we're so excited to have him here, because Greg Jarrett's book, let me see if I can just manage to get my friend. I think you're up, Greg. What do you know? Okay, this technology thing, it's finally coming around for me. It's good to see you. You have it. We talked about recently a little bit about this book. I started reading it the other night, and I loved it, and I was impressed by it, because it's part of our history, and it shows you, I think, in so many ways, what a great country we have, and what a great, you know, system we can have, and how it often is not so good. The book by Greg Jarrett, now just released, is called Trial of the Century, and it looks at this high school teacher who dared, so what was it, in the 1920s? He dared to actually teach evolution, and that was not allowed, right, Greg?
No. In fact, you know, you go back almost 100 years ago, there was this deep religious fervor that swept the nation. And, you know, the Christian fundamentalist movement became all powerful and led by great statesman William Jennings Bryan. And they managed to pass laws in most states that were banning books on science, particularly evolution. They viewed it as a threat to the Bible, the story of man's divine creation. And it didn't conflict. In fact, they're harmonious and they're complementary. And in Tennessee, they took it a step further. And, you know, Trish, they made it a crime for a school teacher to teach evolutionary theory straight out of a state-approved textbook. So it was okay for students to read about it in the textbook, but a teacher dare not mention it. And promptly within days, a young school teacher, 25-year-old John Scopes, was arrested and criminally charged. And the great, the finest trial lawyer who ever lived, Clarence Darrow, who has always been my idol since I was a teenager, and read a book about it.
But that's very interesting. You wanted to be a lawyer back then, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I plucked a volume off my father's bookshelf, and it was a bio on Clarence Darrow. And the more I read, the more I admired his commitment to civil liberties, you know, his passion for the law, his sense of justice. And, you know, his principles became mine. They animated, you know, my own sense of values. And so Darrow is sitting there in Chicago in his fancy law office, and he is utterly incensed that William Jennings Bryan has done this. He has not only helped pass these laws, he has joined the prosecution team to convict Scopes. Darrow immediately steps in and volunteers for free to defend Scopes. So this sets up a titanic clash of two epic figures in American history in a tiny little town of Dayton, Tennessee. And I went there a couple of years ago, and I dug through the archives, and I found the original trial transcript upon which my book, Trial of the Century, is based.
It's such a neat thing, and it's so relevant today, right? Because we're dealing with similar issues in different ways, of course. We're talking with Greg Jarrett. It's just out, Trial of the Century. You can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, probably on your website as well. Trial of the Century, Greg Jarrett's new book. You know, you have this tremendous legal background, and you are a journalist as well. You approach it often with this legal construct. How is it that you came to this particular, I mean, you mentioned that you like Darrow, but did you know about this case before you decided to research it? Which, by the way, all the reviews compliment your tremendous research and highlight just how well done and well researched this book really is. How did you know about it?
Well, as I say, I plucked this book off my dad's shelf, and it was written in 1941, actually, by the wonderful writer that had written, you know, Lust for Life and Agony and the Ecstasy. And, you know, he wrote this biography, but at the end of the book, he talks about the Scopes trial. And it, I always felt like it needed more attention.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I decided, you know, somewhere along the line that maybe one day I might write about this book. What I found so interesting is that most people, anybody under 50, has never heard about the Scopes monkey trial, as the media dubbed it, a popular misconception about evolution. This became the legal blockbuster of a generation. Journalists the world over converged on this tiny town. They had microphones set up in the courtroom. It was the first trial broadcast live to a riveted nationwide radio audience, newsreel cameras in the back of the courtroom. And at the end of the day, they would be shuttled off to a waiting plane, fly it to Chicago, distribution in movie houses everywhere, banner headlines in all the major newspapers across America. And the town itself turned into this sort of carnival-like atmosphere. But the climactic moment, Darrow knows he's losing. The jury is stacked. The judge hates him, ruling against him, won't let him put on a defense. He calls to the witness stand his nemesis, the prosecutor, William Jennings Bryan, as an expert on the Bible. And just says, you can't do that. You can't call the prosecutor. Bryan stands up in all his bluster and bravado. And he says, Your Honor, I volunteer to take the witness stand. I have nothing to hide. I'd love to tell everybody how everything in the Bible should be taken literally. The judge at this point adjourns the courtroom. He's fearful that the crowd will collapse the second floor courtroom. And people are passing out, stifling heat in the middle of the summer, 1925 in Tennessee. So there happened to be a stage outdoors left over from July 4th activity.
Mm-hmm.
I show a picture of Darrow and Bryan face to face with a throng of thousands watching as Darrow cross-examines Bryan and utterly dismantles him and destroyed him. The crowd that came there and adored Bryan began laughing at him and mocking him. By the time it was over, William Jennings Bryan was a broken man. A couple of days later, he laid down for a nap just down the street from the courthouse, and he never woke up.
Oh.
We've got a picture in the book of the casket being loaded onto a Pullman car, being taken up to Arlington National Cemetery up in the Washington area. And, you know, it's an incredible story, but it fundamentally changed free speech rights in America. Free speech was...
Walk me through that, because, you know, obviously you didn't have the freedom to teach. It's bizarre to me that they would have it in the textbook, but not allow the teacher to teach it. And, you know, you have to put yourself in the mindset. Look, I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire in the 70s, and I went to a little Catholic school, and I remember learning all about Adam and Eve, and my mom, when school was done, would also teach me about evolution. But they didn't teach that in Catholic school, but you knew what you were signing up for, right? It was a private school, Catholic school. In the case of the state school in Tennessee, they had it in the textbook, but you weren't allowed to teach it? Walk me through that.
You know, go figure. It's a state-approved textbook of the same legislature that then later voted to criminalize the teaching of that which is in the textbook. And sort of the reasoning was, well, students can read about it, but a teacher can't teach it. So in other words, John Scopes gets arrested for doing his job. I mean, it was outrageous.
Was it all intentional? I mean, he was a substitute teacher. Did he anticipate this in any way?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I mean, that's sort of the backstory. It's funny you point your finger at that part of it because it's an interesting part. You know, so the town of Dayton, Tennessee had been devastated economically when the coal mines closed down. And once this law was passed, the town leaders converged at the drugstore, as they always did back in the day, right?
Hey, well, they sold real Coca-Cola.
Yeah. And they had a soda fountain there. Yeah. And so at any rate, the town leaders get together and say, you know what? Maybe we can revive our economy by drawing attention to Dayton, Tennessee by hosting the trial. Let's find somebody who will be able to challenge the law. And they knew about, you know, John Scopes, small town, everybody knows everybody. Mm-hmm. They send a kid over to the tennis court where Scopes is playing tennis with some of his students, and Mr. Robinson wants to see you. And they go down to Robinson's drugstore, and Scopes walks in, and the drama unfolds from there. And he said, well, yeah, I sort of think I remember teaching evolution to my students. Good enough. They call the newspapers, they call the prosecutor, he's promptly arrested. He volunteered to challenge the law. But thank God he did, because America, you know, Trish, was at the precipice, staring at the abyss of, you know, suffocating learning and science and, you know, asphyxiating free speech in America in favor of censorship by the government. And, you know, we face these same things today, don't you know? I mean,
we are seeing
partisan censorship in political discourse, polarizing disinformation campaigns, classroom indoctrination, you know, this punitive cancel culture under the guise of social justice, you know, whereby conformity of thought supplants robust debate. And so I say to people, if you don't know your history, you're destined to repeat it. And, you know, it seems like we're repeating it.
Oh, well for sure. And in different ways, right? Because it never repeats identically. And in some ways, right, you could look at this and Scopes could, you know, somebody out there who's teaching transgender identity. And by the way, let me just say, like, and I've said this to the listeners before, and they know this, and you and I are friends, so you certainly know this about me. I'm a very... A very compassionate person. And I think we as a society need to be incredibly compassionate. And I'm a little bit libertarian, like you do your thing, I'll do mine. And right, yet what has happened, right, is that it's now become this woke thought, which I remember back in, 2015, 2016, when you used to come on my show at 2 p.m. On Fox Business. One day our producer, Jenna, was like, hey, you know, let's do this story on people who identify as male, or forgive me, female, wanting to use the women's restrooms. And I'm like, but who, like, it's 0.01% of the population. Like, who even, you know, like it's, right. And it shocks me just how quickly, Greg, it's changed. And I remember, like, you know, like, am I going to, if some guy looks like a girl and he's in the bathroom, like, I'm not going to love it, but like, is it going to become a federal case? Well, now we're at the position in society where it's like, if you don't just adhere, if you don't accept, if you don't allow your kids to question, you know, the things that the schools want them to question in terms of their own identity, then somehow you're prejudiced. And so it's kind of I find this book to be so fascinating. It's such an interesting time because we've got like the inverse of it going on right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I try to draw it all together in the epilogue, you know, which is fairly long. But instead of evolutionary theory, the battlefront that has opened up is a different theory. It's called critical race theory. And the problem is that there's no universal agreement on what it is or what it means. There are disparate versions of it. Some are benign, some are not. And I cite...
By the way, that came out of law school theory too, if I'm correct.
Oh yeah, of course it did. But as I cite specific examples and court cases, you know, it is being taught in, you know, secondary education, public schools, and so forth. So it's not just colleges and universities. And
But wouldn't they say in that case, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but that's sort of the scopes guy, right? Like the teacher that's teaching CRT would say, but wait a second, I need to be protected. I need to make sure that I can teach this. And so we, in believing in the First Amendment, say, okay, you know, you can teach what you want to teach within maybe certain guidelines. But it's gotten to the point where it's totally backfired. And now it's no longer sort of, we're teaching this. It's like, you have to believe this. It's an the total indoctrination of society.
Yeah. I mean, in some places, critical race theory simply means that you should accurately and honestly teach American history in a forthright way. And that includes the ugly stain of slavery and racism and segregation and Jim Crow laws and you know, those who oppose civil rights for all. That needs to be honestly dealt with. Students need to learn that. But the polar extreme then is this indoctrination of which you were speaking, in which everybody, kids are being told everybody is in two groups based on the color of your skin, either oppressed or oppressor. And classrooms, especially with young people in them, are suddenly now venues of guilt and shame, which is fundamentally wrong. I think we can all agree on that. We should all agree on that. And so, you know, I think Clarence Darrow, I tried to put myself in the shoes of Clarence Darrow. Darrow always sought common ground, just as he did in The Trial of the Century in my book. You know, he tried to explain to people that evolution and creationism can live in harmony. That is, in fact, the position of Pope Francis, who built on his predecessor's analysis of evolution and creation. As Pope Francis says, evolution presupposes creationism. They are together in our world. And so, you know, Darrow would want that kind of common ground. It's exactly the argument that he made in The Trial of the Century.
It's so interesting and so relevant and so poignant. And I commend you for helping us to remember our history, right? To better understand where we are today, because there is a view and, you know, look, I get kids in school as well. you know, there's sort of this idea that, you know, there is no God, right? When you're studying science, especially some versions of science like astrophysics. And I had to sit my kids down and be like, whoa, like, where are you going with this? And I think, I'm just going to say, I think, especially for young children, that kind of distance from religion and is not healthy, only because, and I say this, you know, people can be whatever they want to be, but I say that because we need to kind of believe in something more and something bigger in life. But if you decide to teach something like, oh, this doesn't exist, or it's exactly this way, then isn't that the same as teaching evolution, right? Not evolution, teaching Adam and Eve and ignoring everything else. It's like, we have to understand the complexity of the world. And I believe have an appreciation for all these different viewpoints, because nothing is black and white.
Yeah, I mean, Darrow said something very poignant in the trial as he's pleading to the judge to dismiss the case. He said, you know, people should be allowed to exercise religion freely, just as people ought to be able to learn freely. And, you know, let's not make the Bible the yardstick by which all science and other educational pursuits are measured. You know, it shouldn't be subjected to a litmus test derived from the book of Genesis. And, you know, that was a very powerful argument. Now, of course, today we know from the Supreme Court that this is a clear violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. Yeah. But what's so interesting is that wasn't binding on the states until two decades after the Scopes trial, the Trial of the Century. You know, the Supreme Court took it on a piecemeal basis. They picked apart nearly every part of the Bill of Rights. And, you know, these are federal rights, and it wasn't made binding by the 14th Amendment on the states in the case of the Establishment Clause until I think it was 1945. And I kept struggling as I'm reading the trial transcript, the original trial transcript. I'm even reading the longhand court reporter notes in beautiful longhand.
Okay.
And I can't figure out why Darrow isn't making this obvious argument. And, you know, it came to me in the middle of the night at about 3 a.m. one night, about 2 weeks later. I woke up in a start in that one of those aha moments. And I got up, I think I know the answer. And I pad through the living room to my office. I pull it up on the computer and there it is. It wasn't until the mid 1940s that Supreme Court made the Establishment Clause binding. So if Darrow had lived for two more decades and tried the case then, it would have been dismissed at the outset, but not in 1925.
Let me ask you about the court today, because, you know, there's been a lot of talk. You've heard the political talk about, OK, we need to put more justices on, stacking the court, as it's known. We seem to have lost faith as Americans in so many institutions, right? Whether it be the Oval Office, whether it be Congress, whether it be the Federal Reserve, whether it be the banking system. I mean, all these sort of institutions, whether it be educational systems as well. And the Supreme Court's part of that, which is kind of tragic, Greg, because, you know, that was sort of the one place where everybody was still up on that pedestal. That has, they've all been knocked off it. And, you know, you think about where we're heading with that. What's your view as a lawyer, as someone who's a legal sort of historical scholar? I think I can call you that, given the tremendous research in this book. What's the danger and where does it take us?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in the First Amendment and free speech, and people ought to be free to criticize anybody and everybody in government. That includes all three branches of government. Yes, we sort of intellectually put Supreme Court justices, those nine people in robes, on a pedestal. But, you know, they're not above or below criticism, and where it's deserved, they ought to be able to tolerate it, and our Constitution tolerates it. I do think it's a silly argument to try to pack the court the way FDR tried to do. It doesn't like the decisions that are being rendered, so let's add more justices to change the complexion and political disposition of the court. That's an ugly pendulum that will then swing back and forth. The opposite party gains power and they'll do the reverse. So, you know, that's silly. And anybody who makes that argument to me,
kind of banana really republic, like, you know, that was a Hugo Chavez move. First thing he did was put all his buddies on the court. The danger is that it can't swing back at that point, you know, that somehow other things start to happen. I just think it's tremendous. I'm seeing a movie here. I just got to say, I mean, as I hear you talk, you know, the producer wheels are turning, certainly a documentary, but this is, I think it could be a massive blockbuster movie. Hope your agent's thinking about that.
Well, thank you so much. That would be interesting. You know, there was a fictionalized version of the Scopes Monkey Trial. It was a Broadway play, I think back in the 40s and 50s, called Inherit the Wind. It was made into a Hollywood movie, black and white, premiered in 1960. Honestly, it did not do well at the box office, notwithstanding, you know, Spencer Tracy playing the fictionalized version of Clarence Darrow, Frederick March playing the novelized version of William Jennings Bryan.
And I think I saw this, H.L.
Mencken, the famed journalist who was not a handsome man, was played by quite a handsome man, Gene Kelly, in the movie. But it didn't do all that well. And I found it so interesting once I read through over and over the original trial transcript. It's more interesting and fascinating.
Well, I'm sure you could do a better job with it than those scriptwriters back then. You know, Trumbo is a movie I recently saw again a couple months ago. I watched it and it was fascinating to me because it's kind of an inverse, right, on everything that was going on. Trumbo was the story of the film writer who couldn't get work in Hollywood because he was blacklisted during the McCarthy days, right, with McCarthyism in full swing. And you see how if you fast forward to today, history is in fact repeating itself. It is a kind of McCarthyism, except just different players, different sides. And so much like what you're talking about with the Trial of the Century, again, you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Greg's website. The book just released today. Really, really fantastic story. And of course, Greg is tremendous as a writer. You've had tons of bestsellers. I know that. So I encourage people to check it out. But it is so relevant, right? Just as Trumbull was. It's something that's happening
maybe all over again.
Cranston.
Maybe Bryan Cranston, who played Trumbull, should play Clarence Darrow in the film version of the Trial of the Century. What do you think?
I like that idea. I think
you're
well connected,
Chris. Get to work on that.
Okay, I'll see if I can get in touch with Brian. Anyway, listen, I so appreciate you coming on. I love that you wrote this, and everybody should go check it out. Trial of the Century by Greg Jarrett, my friend. Very good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Bless you. It's great to see you. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Thanks, Trish.
We'll talk soon. All right. So, wow, we have had a terrific, wonderful show today. A longer one than most, but we've had a couple of great guests and a lot to digest. We're continuing to watch Target's stock price. We're continuing to watch shares of Anheuser-Busch. And we're continuing to watch this market. Overall, this market, which is challenged by, of course, the threat of our leaders not doing what they need to do in order to keep the store effectively open, right? The house from burning down as we look at a market that's off 200 points right now. Listen, I have faith. I have faith. They're a bunch of you-know-whats, but I do have faith that when push comes to shove, they will be able to pull all this off. I want to thank you all for joining. It is so good to see you as always. Do make sure that you subscribe. Subscribe to the channel. Hit the bell. The bell matters, right? Because then you know when I'm here. Otherwise, you gotta search around and hope that the algorithms are doing their thing or that I've figured out the SEO on the back end. So again, love having you here, everyone. And we'll do this again tomorrow. So appreciate it. Until then.